Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
My new book, Diary of a Psychosis, is out. It's the most lively, devastating baseball bat to the throat takedown of what the public health establishment did in 2020 and beyond that you can imagine. It's my first book in 9 years, and you're going to love it. Check it out at diaryofcovid.com. And if you've already bought it, make sure also to visit diaryofcovid.com so you can claim your free bonuses, including my free companion volume, Collateral Damage, a collection of stories from real people who suffered under the restrictions. They weren't allowed to tell their stories at the time, but every one of them told me, "We just want to be heard." Check it all out at diaryofcovid.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Tom Woods Show. This is episode 2456, for heaven's sake. And I'm very glad to be joined by Johnny Burtka, who is president of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. And I saw you speak at an ISI event a year or two ago where I was on a two-person panel with Dan McCarthy. And you gave such a great speech, such interesting remarks about so many different lessons that one might learn from decent statesmen. And you have this book, Gateway to Statesmanship, Selections from Xenophon to Churchill, that just came out this very week. And we're going to talk a little bit about this because of the contrast between the kind of works we see from some of the ancients like Aristotle and Cicero coming up to the moderns, between the kinds of qualities that they look for in statesmen and the kinds of qualities we are observing today. So welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom. It's an honor to be here.
You know, I kind of want to ask you, what among these ideas are you implementing as president of ISI? But that's a subject for another day. So I guess the first thing that occurs to me is, I think a great many of the people being described in this book, like, for example, when St. Thomas Aquinas is talking about kingship, he's thinking about a political figure who is miles and miles removed from the kinds of political figures we have today. But that's, I think, in part a function of the incentives that leaders today face. I think if you're trying to get elected president in the United States, you have to debase yourself in various ways that I think a lot of people of goodwill just wouldn't do. They just refuse to do it. It's a game they don't want to play in the first place. And so when we look, for example, at the various qualities that a Cicero would like to see the statesman exhibit, it's almost like every single one of them is the exact opposite of what we typically see in the U.S.
That's a very astute observation. And it really is unfortunate that if you are running for Senate or running for president, that you really do have to, in your words, debase yourself and grovel before the people, the populace, for 2.5 years, raising hundreds of millions of dollars. This is not a comment on campaign funding. It's an observation about what it takes in our contemporary environment if you want to be the president of the United States or if you want to run for Congress. And all of those qualities, the need for the viral media clip or perpetually needing to kind of punch down and insult your enemies to climb upon their ladder, these are qualities that would have been abhorrent to someone like George Washington. I think going back to our own country, we were originally a republic, right? And that implied certain things. There was the indirect election of senators. It was typically a more educated class of people who were classically trained, who would, for a period of time, begrudgingly be pulled into public life as a, you know, opportunity to serve your country. And it was really about the institutions, whereas today it's about the personalities driving our politics. And you're absolutely right that the ancient world, not just the early American Republic, was much different than the situation we find ourselves in today.
I mean, I wonder if some of that has to do with the difference between the way they viewed politics and the way we view politics. In our day and age, if you listen to, let's say, a State of the Union address, you get the impression that the president is a messianic figure who can remake society anew, who can promise everything to everybody. I mean, how many presidents have we had who have promised to cure cancer? Well, at least two I can think of, probably more. Richard Nixon declared war on cancer in something like 19, 73 or something like that. Just crazy promises. And we sit there and nod like this is all normal. And even though I wouldn't say Aristotle was exactly a libertarian, I don't think that he envisioned the political realm as a place where people ought to be telling us what we should eat and how we should think and how our families should be structured and things like that.
Well, I think what you see kind of an interesting tension, which is going back to the ancient world, sort of the pre-Christian ancient world, the kings were understood to be divine figures. They were linking heaven and earth together. This is sort of the kind of the ancient concept of sacral kingship, which lingered on for quite a while, even in the West, before dying out. But nevertheless, even in that ancient context, the king was a highly institutional figure, right? This was not a personality-driven cult. This was, you know, one king could die, the next one would take his place. They were filling an institutional role. It wasn't about them as an individual. You can see this a little bit if you watch the popular show The Crown today with the role that Queen Elizabeth played. Whereas today, even though we've done away with an institution like kingship, by and large, it is ultimately, over the past 200 years, sort of our republican system has degraded into really just demagoguery is what it takes to kind of get you to the top. And it's interesting that even though we don't believe our political leaders are messianic, they play more of a messianic role than ever before. And I think the same could be said of our social media influencers, of our pop stars. They really are, I think, filling a role that religion used to play in society of ordering people towards more transcendent ends.
Can you say something then about, you know, you have selections from the ancient world and then the medieval world and the Renaissance down to the present. But in the ancient world, which may seem, obviously it's temporally the most remote from us, but culturally and in every other way, probably also seems the most remote. What do they have to say? What do some of the figures whose selections you include have to say to us, in some cases, thousands of years later, that might be relevant?
Sure. Well, they turns out they have a lot to say. And if you just open up this book, really to any of the selections, you'll find that they're taking the world of theory and they're really tying it to a practical application, because these were gifts for very busy statesmen. And so they needed it dumbed down, so to speak, so that they could really quickly implement it. But I think the most important thing that you see going back to ancient Persia, when Xenophon is describing the education of Cyrus, you see in ancient China with Han Fei's writings, and you see it in India with Kautilya, they all start with the same thing, and that is self-control. A great leader must have self-mastery over their passions, whether that's food, drink, any addiction, any other thing, even if it's their pride, they must have self-control. And they think it's universally, they would say it's impossible to have a great leader who doesn't have self-control. So that is a foundational principle. And I think it's, you know, ultimately aligns quite well with the advice in the Christian world about pursuing virtue. This is something that's done through trial and error at first. And oftentimes people don't want to become virtuous, but it does take practice. And eventually your desires will be ordered to follow your action. But you really do it from a young age, really through education, have to practice that exercise and self-control.
Okay, so now if further, let's find further remoteness from our current day. Well, actually, you know what? Let me put it this way. When I think about the kind of person who tends to run for president, now I can think of some honorable people who have done it. So I wouldn't say that it's all terrible people. But in order to win, I feel like in at least a lot of cases, you have to make concessions to very substantial interest groups. There are very often at least implicit promises to various donors. And so, yes, again, it's not like most people today would say, I would rather have a monarchy, although I probably would, because I don't see how it could get any worse. But at least the thing with the monarch was, especially a medieval monarch, was the medieval monarch could not simply do anything he wanted. Mm-hmm. He was hemmed in by all kinds of other grouping. So there could be aristocrats or guilds or geographical regions or peoples whose liberties he was supposed to protect but not invade. And so he didn't have plenary authority the way I think most high school students think a medieval king had. And so because he goes into office knowing that his authority is limited, he tends to be, I think, not as ambitious, not as corruptible, because there's less that you can get out of the king. So you don't have every single interest group at his ear at all times. And I think that's a major thing that's changed.
It has, yeah. And I think people often overstate in their imagination how much power, not authority, a king would have had in a medieval context, right? It was, to your point, highly limited in terms of the spheres in which they could operate. There were all sorts of pressure groups kind of hemming them in and constraining their behavior, even if they didn't have the institutional checks and balances. Unfortunately, in our system today, as the institutional checks and balances have eroded, we have a bureaucratic state that I think is more like an oligarchy than really a tyrannical despot, because even the president himself doesn't control the bureaucracy in Washington, D.C. You know, the bureaucracy is sort of its own thing with its own interests, right? And unfortunately, today we actually have the largest organism or entity in the history of mankind is the federal government in Washington, D.C. right now, regardless of any forms of government. But I guess going back to your original point about political favors and also the kind of the character of leaders, Cicero did say we have to watch out because he was operating in the context where Caesar was about to overthrow the Republic in ancient Rome. And Cicero was trying to restore and revive Roman republicanism. And he said, you really do have to watch out, though, because the type of people that are interested in politics, at least in that context, were highly ambitious, which there's nothing wrong with ambition, but he said so much so that they want to wield sole authority. And that is the quality that he saw in Caesar, which he thought would be particularly dangerous to the Republic. And then also the kind of the idea of needing to give favors, it often depends on the context. So it may be true that in the case of a medieval Catholic monarch in Austria-Hungary, you might not need to do as many favors because you already have your empire established. But if you're Xenophon and you're describing Cyrus, and this is a young conqueror who's conquering from Persia all the way over to Greece, the only way he does it is with an extensive patronage network that he builds out so that he can reward his friends and punish his enemies. And that is really a core foundation of him establishing power. So in some ways, the past is better. In other ways, all these same human problems emerge in different forms.
Hey, everybody, it's Ol Woods here with a mini interview with our friend Jeff Deist, whose appearances on the Tom Woods Show you all love so much. And we're talking about monetary metals, where he works now, and you've heard me talk about this nonstop. So now it's going to be Jeff's turn to talk about it. Jeff, tell me about monetary metals. What is the value here?
Well, Tom, remember back in the day when Ron Paul used to ask Ben Bernanke, then chairman of the Federal Reserve, what's gold? What's the purpose of gold? Is it money? Why does the Fed hold it? And of course, he waffled and said, it's a historical relic and it's just a precious metal, but it's not. I mean, for more than 5,000 years, gold's been money. There's $13 trillion worth of it out there just sitting around in bank vaults. Why don't we generate some interest from that? Why don't we put it to work as money, as a capital asset? That's the idea behind monetary metals.
So what does a person have to do to be part? Do you have to come in there owning your own gold? Do they sell you the gold? How does it work?
Absolutely not. Whether you've got physical metals that you want to ship to us safely or whether you want to simply send a bank wire or a check, we can convert your money into gold and get you started earning interest right away.
All right, everybody, check it out. monetary-metals.com/woods. I have an account there. I know the people who work there. We all know Jeff Deist. So check it out for yourself, monetary-metals.com/woods. What is this genre called the Mirrors for Princes tradition?
Yeah, so the Mirrors for Princes tradition, think of it today, you know, today we have a million business books. If you want to become, you know, the next great entrepreneur, you read Peter Thiel's Zero to One, you read Jim Collins' Good to Great. You know, we have a million self-help books offering practical tips for entrepreneurs. We don't have anything for statesmen. And so in the ancient world, they had mirrors for princes. And this was really an educator or a hopeful political advisor would put together a very short letter or book, and they would present it to a new king or queen offering their services. The educator would hope to be the tutor to the king or queen's young children. And a political advisor would be saying, hey, you know, here are my ideas on how you can practically be a wise and effective leader. Pick me to be your advisor, to be, in today's terms, your cabinet. And so these pieces of advice, moral advice, policy advice, were some of the most popular books in all of Western history, and they existed in nearly every culture and civilization.
Now, sometimes people cite, and of course now this is much later, Machiavelli's The Prince as an example of this genre, although it's not, you know, it would be a case of which one of these is not like the others. With Machiavelli, you have some controversy among students of his, modern students of his, as to what exactly he was driving at and whether he was amoral or, you know, whether he's a pragmatist or whatever any of what he was saying was supposed to mean. What do you think's going on in The Prince, and particularly in the selection that you chose?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So there are many people who have written about Machiavelli that are far wiser than I am. I see him, well, he's a rupture, certainly from the Christian tradition of Thomas Aquinas or St. Augustine. I read Machiavelli as being relatively in line with many of the texts from antiquity that I discovered. Xenophon's The Education of Cyrus, the ancient Chinese text, the ancient Indian text. What I mean by that is they had a very realist outlook that was really rooted in power politics. And I think the interests of the state of the regime as a whole really trumped both personal morality and also kind of individual, I would say individual rights, because their focus in the ancient world was really on establishing order even before they could begin to lay the foundations for justice. And so I do see Machiavelli as operating as part of this ancient tradition. Obviously, in his own context, he had a lot of challenges with the papacy. He served in kind of leadership roles in a republic that was overthrown in part by the Pope with the help of the Spanish. At various points of his life, he was imprisoned, exiled, tortured, and then he was eventually sort of living out in the country on his estate. He was writing his book, The Prince, you know, I think with the aim of really reviving the Florentine Republic. And so this is a guy who had been through the ringer. He had seen, I don't know if it's fair to say the worst of humanity, but he had seen kind of the most raw power politics imaginable. So he's writing a book, basically, if you're a political leader, how do you survive amidst this chaotic context in Italy during the Renaissance period? And so his advice is brutal, it's cold, it's calculating, but I also think it's generally realistic in the sense of, even if you're a good person, political leadership, you need to understand his arguments because people will use these tactics against you.
All right, now I am speaking primarily to a libertarian audience. So their inclination might be to say, rather than hope for the proper education of the statesman, in our day and age, you know, in which everything, every institution seems corrupt and our political system seems beyond reform, shouldn't I instead consider it to be more fruitful simply to try to scale back the scope of this regime as opposed to trying to find a wise ruler to guide it?
Sure. Well, so I think that's a really great question. It actually gets back to one of the most fundamental, I think, dilemmas within this Mirrors for Princes tradition is, do you put your hopes on a great individual leader or ruler, or do you put your hopes in institutions? And with Cyrus the Great back in ancient Persia, kind of Xenophon paints this portrait of this amazing, conquering, heroic leader. But then as soon as he dies, everything falls to pieces, right? Everything falls to pieces. And so it's a question about, was he really a good ruler if the moment that he's gone, he never built any institutions that were capable of preserving the prosperity and the liberty that he had established? And so I think at the end of the day, the reality is you need both great leaders and good institutions that are based on principles that endure the test of time. So I think to some extent, it's a chicken and an egg thing. What comes first? Unfortunately, I think the worse that conditions get in our own regime, the harder it is to claw them back through institutional means. It's kind of like pulling the emergency brake, right? So essentially what we have is Congress is doing whatever they, you know, the administrative state is kind of running on inertia and it's doing really whatever it wants. Congress is really doesn't appear to be in much control over anything. And then you have the Supreme Court, I think, pulling the emergency brake on things. But that's really no substitute for, I think, the education and the character building that's ultimately needed to raise up the leaders who could restore the republic. And I do think that task of restoring the American republic will require strong individual leadership in ways that I think for periods of time might make a libertarian feel uncomfortable. But I think the aim is to restore an order where ordered liberty is preserved. You're going to have someone who's going to fight, right, the oligarchy, and that will require strong leadership.
Well, we can think of Javier Milei in Argentina as an example I think libertarians would be comfortable with. And also, I think even though he was never in the executive branch, there's no doubt that in his own way, Ron Paul exhibited a kind of leadership in that he attempted to lead by example through his congressional votes, even if he voted all alone. He did that a lot, you know, 434-1, an awful lot. If it's 380-55, well, nobody really cares. But if it's 434-1, you wonder, who is that guy? You know, it makes you wonder. And so in a very different way from, I think, the way some of these statesmen exerted leadership, he exerted it in a unique way in that he got young people to read big treatises on economics. You know, I don't think anybody Machiavelli advised ever got to quite that level.
That is true. For the libertarians in the audience, Machiavelli does have this line. So throughout this tradition, you do see a frequent, and it's recurring. You see it in Cicero all the way to Machiavelli, warnings about you should keep taxes low. Don't have taxes be too high, or else the people will hate you and you're gonna quash kind of the economic engines of growth in the regime. And there's a funny line from Machiavelli, and he says, a man will sooner forgive you if you kill his father than if you take his land. It's a little bit hyperbolic, but it kind of gets to the point of every great leader has to understand that you cannot be too overbearing with taxes. And Cicero also makes a strong defense of private property, and he's really, really skeptical of populist demagogues trying to kind of despoil the rich and redistribute the wealth. And so you can certainly find a lot of libertarian themes in many of these great classic writers.
Right. I don't mind if the populist demagogue is saying everybody else in this regime is robbing you blind and I'm going to try to stop them from doing that. If he says that.
Sure. And that's the truth. Well, I mean, it's not, you know, if it's the truth, then that's not entirely, you know, riling people up about the truth. I'm totally fine.
Yeah. Absolutely fine with that. Let's thank our sponsor, Blinkist. I'm genuinely super proud to have sponsors of the quality of Blinkist. We are dealing with information overload in our day and age, and a great way to cope with it is with the Blinkist app. With the Blinkist app, you can absorb an enormous amount of information. You can almost sound like Scott Horton, and you can absorb it in 27 different nonfiction categories. So we're talking history, philosophy, parenting, career, technology, religion, on and on. Blinkist condenses each book into 15-minute summaries you can read or listen to. So that means if you have a half-hour commute each way, you can absorb the equivalent of 4 books. You think that might make you a more impressive person? And as I've said before, among the thousands and thousands of titles across all these categories at Blinkist, you'll even find libertarian classics by people like Murray Rothbard and Milton Friedman, and even a book by Ole Woods here. Well, right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/woods to start your 7-day free trial and get 25% off a premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/woods to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/woods. And now for a limited time, you can even use Blinkist Connect to share your premium account. You'll get 2 premium subscriptions for the price of 1. Before the modern period, who would be an example of somebody you think exhibited the kind of leadership that you would like to see and was properly, let's say, was properly formed, perhaps, by the kind of education you'd like to see for statesmen?
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question. Let me just give a moment to kind of think through. There's so many great options. So to me, I go to Thomas More. Now, he himself wasn't the king. he wasn't the statesman, but this is a man who had very profound political and even theological and religious convictions. And in his book, The Utopia, which I've included in this collection, he's debating this character named Raphael, who's sort of a wayfaring intellectual, a man of the world. And he encourages Raphael to get in the business of politics. And Raphael says, oh, no, you know, I'm far too good to get in the business of politics. If I give advice to a political leader, they're just going to mess up my beautiful idea. I want to stay out of the fray. And Thomas More basically calls him a fool and says, you don't understand how this works. Each of us has to take the play or the drama that is at hand, right? We can't just give up on our country, on our civilization, because they're not playing the play that we want them to play. We're all pulled onto the stage, we're actors, and we have to play our part. And so in Thomas More's own life, he really kind of embodied this. He was sort of a man in the arena. He never gave up the ship in the storm, and he was willing to get his hands dirty in the business of politics up until the point in which his own faith was tested, right? When he was called to effectively renounce his Catholic faith in service of the king, and then he gave his head for his country. And he said his famous last words, I died the king's good servant, but God's first. I do think that's a lesson for us today, because if we are going to save the American Republic, I do think it will take people not just sitting on the sidelines, but actually getting into the fray of politics and really making an impact at the local level, the state level, and when appropriate, at the national level, and doing it in such a way that you don't abandon your principles. And I think Thomas More offers a great model for that.
Well, indeed. I mean, I think he thought that Henry was making a totalitarian move by trying to make himself the head of the church in England. And it's interesting to note that, so his martyrdom, I mean, I suppose a Catholic would consider him a martyr. So his martyrdom occurred in 1535, and then it was 400 years exactly later that he was canonized. But then in the year 2000, Pope John Paul II named him the patron saint of politicians and statesmen, which was, I think a rather an interesting move to say that your patron is somebody who was so dedicated to his beliefs that he would give everything before betraying them. Well, that's quite an example to live up to.
It is. It's a high bar, but you'll see also with many of these authors that I've included in this collection, many of them whom advised political leaders, they ended up dying very cruel and unusual deaths, because getting involved in politics, counseling kings, right, especially in the ancient world, this was quite a dangerous business.
Let me ask you personally, Johnny Burtka, not anybody in this tradition, but you personally, looking at America 2024, are you, let's say, well, I'm probably, you know, all these different pill colors. You could be red pilled, blue pilled, but there's also white pilled and black pilled. Or you'll see individual episodes in history or in the present that are encouraging, and that's a white pill for you. Mm-hmm. But then you see like the masses have some crazy, stupid idea, and that's a black pill.
Sure.
Where do you come down if you had to pick one, and why?
Yeah. So I understand the mentality behind the black pill, and I certainly feel that from time to time. But I'm fundamentally a hopeful person. That's informed by my faith, but it's also informed by, as I look at the country today, I think in many ways things have gotten a lot worse than they were, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, certainly. But at the same time, I think a lot of our problems, they've reached a more existential point. And what that does is I think it's basically alerted a large percentage of the population that was previously kind of fine to go along with the flow. It's kind of woken up, I think, a pretty large segment of the country who sees how the education system is failing us, how the economy is failing us right now, how our, you know, just basic kind of law and order is breaking down in so many places and so many cities. The problems that we face are reaching an existential point. So in one sense, you could say, oh, they're getting worse, therefore that's the black pill. But I actually think that there is a hunger right now and a hope for men and women of principle to come forward. I actually think righting the ship of America, even though there's so many problems that are so complex and so deep, you could actually do a few very fundamental, simple things, and you could really steer this country in a direction that would be much healthier and better than the course we're on. So I kind of think that is the worse that the problems get, to some extent, they're easier to fix because they're more existential. You know, it's like if you were eating a, you know, if you drank a liter of Coca-Cola every day and ate McDonald's three times a day, to some extent, that's a little bit easier of a problem to fix if you have heart condition than if you didn't have those and it was some other factor causing it. Because you can just say, well, you need to stop eating McDonald's, stop drinking the liter of cola. And so I think, so to me, the worse things have gotten, the more I think Americans have woken up and want to change. And I think we have enough good people in this country that will rise, you know, into the foreground when we need it.
Well, the book is, once again, Gateway to Statesmanship, Selections from Xenophon to Churchill, edited with an introduction by our friend John Burtka. Now, I know you as Johnny because I've always seen you that way, but published under that name and by Regnery Gateway, I don't even want to bring up the sad story behind the publisher that you and I have known so well, was recently acquired by another publisher, but we're confident that it will continue to put out good quality books such as this one well into the future. So thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.